I was able to get my second guest here, Dr. Carlstrom, and we're going to be switching our guests tonight because our second guest will be Richard Gage. And are you there, Eric? Oops. Are you there, Eric?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Too many buttons. Okay, Eric Carlson is professor of geography, California State University Stanislaus, former professor of geography at Northern Arizona University and the University of Kansas, author and co-author of 23 professional papers on soils, geomorphology, and paleoclimate, which have been published in the peer-reviewed national and international journals, author of 20 additional papers which have appeared in non-refereed journals, guidebooks, and books. Director and composer of the documentary film An Awakening Journey, Songs and Voices from the Earth. Composer, recording artist, and performer, piano, guitar, banjo, and vocals. In fact, that was his recording that we just listened to on the tape with Jerome Corsi. And 9 CDs, tapes, including The River, University Days, The Bluegrass Conspiracy, Mountain Sage, Reflections, Eric and Karen Finding Home, Colorado Colors, and some pretty good love songs. Okay, Eric is my co-host normally, and tonight he's on the radio here, but he's coming in from Crestone. So what we're going to do is we're going to address an issue on the drilling down in the Baca Grande with Lexan, and I'll let you go ahead and get started here, Eric.
Okay, I guess you'd like to have kind of an update, is that right?
Yes, we did. We did approach the subject a couple of months ago.
We did an interview before several months ago and tried to fill people in as to what was going on then, and now things have moved forward, so I'll just kind of set the stage and try to bring people up to date as to what's happening. About a year and a half ago, that is to say about July or August of 2006, our community learned that a Canadian exploration company, Lexam Explorations Incorporated, had applied for permits to drill two 14,000-foot exploratory gas wells on the brand newly formed Baca National Wildlife Refuge, which is just right next to our little Baca Grande community. In fact, now they are wanting to drill three 14,000-foot holes, and these are basically on Willow Creek and Spanish Creek. They're on wetlands where the streams kind of fan out and onto the plain of the San Luis Valley, just a mile and a half from the western boundary of our Baca Grande community. Our community is, first of all, we set up a little group to try to help the wildlife refuge come up with some best management practices that would get written into the permits issued by the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We did that, and many of those recommendations were written in. We did this so that we could try to get some very basic protections, because we know how invasive and polluting and devastating oil and gas exploration is throughout the rest of the Rocky Mountains right now. It's all over the state, and so we studied up as best we could, learned what we could from other communities that had dealt with this before, and made these recommendations to Ron Garcia, who is the director of the new wildlife refuge. At the beginning, the Wildlife Refuge told us that they did not have to follow a NEPA process. NEPA stands for National Environmental Policy Act. It's a law in 1969 that is really the Magna Carta of environmental protection. And it mandates that anytime there's a potentially damaging activity or project proposed for a federal piece of land, such as the National Wildlife Refuge, that agency has to go through a process which involves the public and determines whether or not there are significant impacts associated with the project, et cetera. And the reason that the Wildlife Refuge told us originally that they didn't have to go through a NEPA process was because although the National Wildlife Refuge owns the surface estate, this Canadian corporation, Lexam, owns the subsurface mineral rights. So the Baca Wildlife Refuge said, hey, there's nothing we can do about it anyway. It's a private property right. They, you know, there's nothing we can do. Subsequently, one of our groups here in Crestone, the San Luis Valley Ecosystem Council, which is actually kind of a valley-wide group but centered here, got some environmental lawyers out of Durango to sue the Wildlife Refuge to get them to follow a NEPA process, and which they, a federal judge said, you have to follow the NEPA process. There's no two ways about it. So after that, then the National Wildlife Refuge belatedly started a scoping process and told us that they were going to have a private contractor paid by Lexan write an environmental assessment, an EA. And they started a 30-day comment period from the locals as part of a scoping process. Well, our community came out in force, even though they only gave us 10 days notice. They only notified us 10 days in advance that there would be a public meeting. So we really, all along, we've had the real strong sense that the government is just completely in collusion with the Lexam to try to get this thing through fast track. And that's not surprising because that's what's happened all over the West under this administration. And I can go into that if you want to. But basically, despite the fact that they tried to slip this under the radar, we filled the room with people and we spoke for 3 hours and we told them all the reasons why we thought it would be a terrible idea to have gas and oil drilling in our backyard on the new wildlife refuge. And at that point, Mike Blendon, who is the regional director of the Wildlife Refuge, said, well, it's nice to hear your comments, but what we want is you to write your comments down and send them in to us. So over the next 30 days, 49,000 people wrote comments.
Wow.
I know I wrote about 12 pages or 15 pages because I'm part of a, I should have mentioned this, I'm part of a group called the Water Watch Alliance. Originally, we were didn't have a name. We were just helping Ron Garcia with best management practices. There were about 8 of us. Then we morphed into the San Luis Valley Citizens Alliance. And then about a year ago, maybe 14 months ago, people in our group said, hey, water is the issue here. You know, this is a priceless resource worth trillions of dollars. It's maybe the largest freshwater aquifer in North America. And it's sitting on the edge of the arid Southwest. So this aquifer needs to be protected from potential contamination from gas and oil. So anyway, I wrote my, and I'm a professor, so I can research and I can write and I can read. And I wrote this long letter and to Mike Blendon. I wrote 2 or 3 long letters to the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I copied all these letters to the Senator Salazar and Congressman Salazar and Representative Gail Schwartz and you name it, you know. Anyway, so we flooded them with comments. On January 18th, the Fish and Wildlife Refuge released the environmental assessment. Now, I feel like I'm talking too much, but I need to set the stage here. The NEPA process can go in 2 directions. If there is a finding of no significant impacts for the project, then all the Wildlife Refuge has to do, and the contractor, in this case Lexan, has to do is write an environmental assessment, which is kind of the short, quick and dirty version. If there are found to be significant impacts, potential significant impacts with the project, then federal law mandates that they write a full-blown environmental impact statement, or EIS. Well, to us here who've been researching this, drilling 2 or 3 14,000-foot gas test wells on wetlands in a brand-new National Wildlife Refuge, all 3 of which have the potential to contaminate a priceless aquifer, well, these are very, very significant impacts. And not only that, but this place is littered with archaeological sites, some of the oldest sites in the country. you know, or in the, just east of, or west of the sand dunes, going back to 11,500 years. And there's about 500 generations worth of Native American activity represented in this valley. That's everything from 11,500 years ago to now. And so, you know, anyway, there's so many potential impacts. But the document that came out, the draft environmental assessment, never has a conclusion section. But it
is that typical, Eric, to have a conclusion section?
Well, I tell you the truth, I've been so busy teaching over the years that I haven't actually looked at a lot of these documents. But I would have assumed that somewhere in this document it would say, we have looked at the data and we have found that there are no significant impacts.
Well,
but what they did was they broke down all our 49,000 letters into 10 concerns, you know, things like wildlife, soils, cultural values, noise pollution, water pollution, air pollution, things like this. And in each of those sections, which are only about a page and a half each, and none of them have any data for the most part, there's a little bit of data on the wildlife thing, they say significant no significant impacts or minimal impacts throughout. So what they do is they imply throughout the document that there are minimal impacts, but they never examine what those impacts might be. So these documents, these NEPA documents, either the EA, the Environmental Assessment, or the EIS, the Environmental Impact Statement, have the mandate by federal law to examine impacts, alternatives, and mitigation measures. Well, this particular document examines alternatives, and it examines mitigation measures, but it doesn't examine impacts. So basically, this is a glossy 144-page boilerplate whitewash. It's a joke, and yet now we have another public meeting on February 12th, which I believe is next week, a week from tonight, and we have until March 2nd. Now, again, they've given us a deadline in which to get our responses in to this joke of an environmental assessment. It's a draft environmental assessment. And then once they take our comments at the next point, then they can decide, okay, we'll just, you know, make a few minor modifications, and then we'll come out with the final environmental assessment. That's if they can somehow justify to themselves that there are no significant impacts. Or if they're, you know, halfway fair and logical and reasonable and honest about it, they'll say, gosh, yeah, there's a lot of potential significant impacts. We better do an environmental impact statement, which will take another 2 years or so. So our community is quite convinced that an EIS is what's called for, but we also now have seen this pattern of collusion between the government and industry here. And so we are expecting that they're going to come back and weasel word their way into saying that there are no significant impacts and the environmental assessment is enough, therefore Lexham can start drilling. At which point, we are dearly hoping that the lawyers from the Energy Minerals Law Center in Durango, Brad Bartlett and Travis Stills, who did the injunction, the lawsuit first, that they're going to file another lawsuit. But because our local community now has split up into three different groups, the Ecosystem Council has been associated with the lawyers, and another group now has started called the San Luis Valley Citizens Alliance, and then my group, which is the oldest, is called Water Watch Alliance. I'm not 100% sure that this lawsuit is going to occur, but we've been told that it is. And then who knows what's going to happen. But in the very near future, that is to say between now and March 2nd, what we need is to play their game. And we've been playing their game, and frankly, I'm quite disgusted with it because we're doing our side in good faith and they don't listen to a thing we say. But in a way, if we get enough people to write letters to the Fish and Wildlife and to your politicians, the Salazar brothers and Gail Schwartz and county representatives, et cetera, county commissioners, then it's possible to force our foot into the door and push that door open a little bit more so that the public can get back into the process. The NEPA process guarantees public input. It guarantees input from other stakeholders like the county and other agencies which might be affected. And from what I can tell, the in their haste to get this company drilling on their refuge, neither the Fish and Wildlife Refuge or NSER have notified many of the important stakeholders. For instance, water. Let me just mention water, because I'm with Water Watch Alliance. By the way, Water Watch Alliance is strictly a no-go outfit. It's our belief that there should be no gas and oil drilling in the San Luis Valley because of the water and because it can be contaminated and then future generations aren't going to have good water. The other two groups, the Ecosystem Council, the Citizens Alliance, seem right now to be all into mitigation and playing the game. Our group sees, okay, it's a good idea to play the mitigation game, try to minimize the impact, but any impact that contaminates the aquifer is unacceptable, and there is no bonding amount. I've heard the bond amount has gone now from $10,000 to $1 million. It's still pathetic. I mean, there's no amount. You couldn't put a bonding amount for $1 trillion because once the aquifer is contaminated, it's contaminated. But anyway, going back to my story about the water, we have here in the San Luis Valley an extension of the Rio Grande Rift Zone, and this extends down to Santa Fe and Albuquerque. And we are the upper headwaters of the Rio Grande. So the Rio Grande heads up in the San Juan Mountains to the west of Alamosa, flows down to Alamosa, and then heads down into New Mexico. We are the San Luis Valley, which is one of the highest agricultural valleys in the world, and a jewel and a treasure because of the wildlife, because of the fact that it's sacred to so many Indian tribes, the fact there's so many archaeological sites, the fact that there's so many spiritual groups here, the fact that we have so many 14ers in the Sangre de Cristo. There's so many reasons that this area is a unique and sacred, irreplaceable place. But anyway, we're the headwaters of the Rio Grande River in addition to that. Now, the Rio Grande goes through southern Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and is shared also with Mexico. Two-thirds of the Rio Grande is shared with Mexico. If you look at the Rio Grande Basin, it supplies water, municipal water, industrial water, irrigation water, mostly irrigation water, to about 10 million people. Okay, we are the headwaters. Under the terms of the Rio Grande Compact of 1938, Colorado, the state of Colorado, it's mandated that Colorado deliver a certain quantity and quality of water to New Mexico at the border every year. And that quantity varies depending on, you know, how wet the year is. We are responsible to give them a certain amount, and New Mexico, in turn, is responsible to give Texas a certain amount, and Texas, again, is responsible to give some certain amount to Mexico. And as far as I can tell, the stakeholders that are downstream of us, because they are downstream of us, don't even know that this is going on. The Middle Rio Grande Conservation District, for instance, which is a large outfit that adjudicates the water in the Albuquerque and New Mexico area, I'm sure they haven't been notified. I don't think they know. I don't think this story has made it into the Albuquerque newspapers or the Santa Fe newspapers. I mean, this is their water, too. And it is my hope as a member of Water Watch Alliance that one function that we can fulfill is to try to notify these other stakeholders that haven't been notified by the Wildlife Refuge, or certainly haven't been notified by Lexham, that this plan is in the works and that there is potential here for contaminating their water. Now, let me just say also that the way that the Fish and Wildlife have massaged this whole process in order to come to this foregone conclusion that they hope to come to, which is that the Lexan can get on the ground and that there are considered no significant impacts. The way they're doing that is they're saying we're only looking at the impacts of the exploratory wells. Now, if they actually hit something, then we'll go through the process again. Well, this is, I think, disingenuous in the extreme, because this, you know, if they hit something, then what would happen, my oil and gas contacts tell me, is they would immediately publicize that, and they would, what they would do then is they would turn over, and they'd say, look, we've got it. And they'd turn over the operation to their partner. Now, Lexham owns 75% of the mineral rights under the Baca Wildlife Refuge. The other 25% are owned by ConocoPhillips, the third largest gas and oil, you know, drilling company in the world. They're the ones doing the production of gas up on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, gas and oil. And so anyway, then you'd have a land rush, and then they would cookie cutter the permits, and it would be very, very difficult to slow it down at that point to get an environmental impact statement. Then the forces of greed and the land rush would begin. And if Lexham is right, and if there is a lot of gas and oil down there, or gas is what they're hoping for or thinking they're going to find, then this valley could be full of hundreds or potentially even thousands of gas wells. And, of course, with that comes an entire infrastructure, including roads and pipelines and compressors and evaporation ponds and, you know, surface pollution and subsurface pollution and tremendous noise pollution and light pollution and air pollution. And so we could just about kiss the quality of this valley goodbye, this very, very special place. So we are, we're hoping that, we're praying, of course. Crestone's got a lot of spiritual people here. A lot of people are praying. I personally have the attitude of the old Russian proverb, which is pray to God, but keep rowing to shore. So I have been working these last several months on putting together a website. And let me give you that just in case anybody is interested in finding out more about this. I'm not tremendously skilled in computers. I can, you know, word process, et cetera. But my next-door neighbor here is good, and he showed me how you could make a website free with Google Pages. So I've the website is called, please get your pencils out if you're out there in listening land and you'd like to write a letter. I can tell you who to write it to, but let me first give you the website. It's www.waterwatchalliance, all one word, waterwatchalliance.googlepages, all one word, .com. And if you go to that site, you will have several pages you can choose from. And, you know, I apologize, it may not be all that expertly laid out, but there are 6 or 7 pages you can go to, and I would suggest that you check out each one of them, because some of them are mislabeled, because I'm still trying to figure out how to label and relabel those things. Like I say, I'm not great at this. But it's coming along, and there's a lot of information in there, and in a couple of the pages I have addresses and names of politicians, congressmen, commissioners that you could call or write or email. In another page I have, on the page on Rio Grande Water and the San Luis Valley Aquifer page, I have names and addresses of people in the relevant water conservation districts, many of whom I think have not been consulted on this. What I think we need to do, you know, the time is running out. Obviously, we'd like to have a blitzkrieg of input to the Mike Blendon of the Wildlife Refuge.
Do you have any idea where, you know, 49,000 letters, I mean, that sounds like, I mean, that's a lot of people. Do you think that all came from that San Luis Valley?
No, that's a good point, Melody. What happened was Chris Canale of the Ecosystem Council had some contact with somebody at the NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, and they put out a mass emailing, and they somehow got people to sign on to a petition or write whatever in. And most of those, some 48,000, came in on computer disk. And so, it's, yeah, I'm glad you kind of called me on that because, you know, it's tempting to say, oh, we got 49,000 responses. But, you know, probably the real number in terms of paper is more like 1,000 or less. And I think that the Fish and Wildlife didn't consider that computer disk with all those comments and signatures on the computer as very important. So, yeah, 49,000, that sounds better than it really is.
And why do you think that Lexham zeroed in on this wildlife refuge? Do you have any kind of speculation on that?
Oh, good point. Okay, I'm going to have to give you a little more background. Now, some of you people, I think, Melody, you know, and many people who've lived around here know, that back in the 80s, there was an attempt by a Canadian corporation called American Water Development Incorporated, AWDI. And this was the company of Maurice Strong, who had bought the Baca land grant, the Baca Ranch, about 200,000 acres. And he formed this company, AWDI, and he tried to export our water from our confined aquifer, which is the big one, over to the Denver area in the Front Range. And, of course, if he had succeeded in doing that, it would have been a multi-billion dollar profit for his corporation. Local environmentalists stopped that, and also very, very high in the United Nations and wears not only a developer gas and oil and water hat because he's been CEO of many, many corporations, huge corporations in Canada, like Petro-Canada and Power Corp and Hydro-Canada. I mean, just about every huge corporation he's been, you know, head of at one point. He's also been virtual head of this United Nations for the last 30 years. And he decided, of course, he has this conflicting role. At one point, he's wearing his white hat. He's the environmentalist who organized the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. He's the environmentalist who organized the Stockholm Environmental Conference, International Environmental Conference for the UN back in 1972. There are all these environmental programs, World Wildlife Foundation with Prince Bernard. I mean, you're talking just the ruling elite here. So on the one hand, he's a good guy with a white hat helping environmental causes. On the other, he's this billionaire who's been in control of lots of very, very rich power and water corporations, amongst others. So anyway, at the point where he was challenged by the environmentalists and the ranchers around here, a coalition, he decided that he would try to maintain his image as an environmentalist. He gave up his AWDI. He sold the ranch to Gary Boyce, who's a local valley guy. And Gary Boyce was going to be kinder and gentler and a better steward and all this stuff. But then a few years later, in the 90s, he tried a scheme to export the water and make billions. He also was thwarted, and he partnered up with another bunch of people in his corporation called Falleron. He wound up losing control of it. They wound up selling to the Nature Conservancy about 98, 99. And the Nature Conservancy held it for about 3 years and then sold it to the U.S. government.
So you're saying Nature Conservancies don't hold things in perpetuity?
Excuse me, what?
You're saying nature conservancies don't hold lands in perpetuity?
Well, I really don't know, Melody, but I know in this case they acted as a middleman.
Okay, all right.
And they were the ones who had the funds and the name to hold the property until the government could come up with the money for it. Now, what happened was when our Great Sand Dunes National Monument was changed into a national park in a law in the year 2000, kind of piggybacked on that same legislation, they designated the Baca National Wildlife Refuge, the year 2000. But the Congress didn't have money at that point to buy it. Now, it's interesting to note that the the money, the land is being traded off. Now it's whittled down from 200,000 acres to 92,000 acres. The sale price supposedly was about $34 million. But Maurice Strong had severed the mineral rights from the surface rights back when he owned the property back in the 80s or 70s even. And so now the Nature Conservancy sold the surface rights to the wildlife refuge, the U.S. government, but the subsurface mineral rights were still owned by Lexan. And at that point, at the point of the sale, what I understand is that the mineral rights could have been bought for $1 million, while the surface estate was sold for $34 million. So it really quite a tiny amount. But this is not what happened. They kept these things separate. So when the wildlife refuge was established, they did not own the subsurface mineral rights. And that was okay because nobody thought there was any gas and oil in the valley. Except Lexham supposedly had drilled two holes a little bit south of the wildlife refuge on what's now the national park, and they claim they drilled two 5,000-foot wells and got, quote-unquote, oil shows. and that got them buying up all the 2D seismic and 3D seismic and doing some new 3D seismic to evaluate the potential for full-scale gas and oil operation.
So the Baca Ranch, is that included in that at all?
Okay, the original Baca Ranch, yes it is. The original Baca Ranch was 200,000 acres. This was one of the original Spanish land grants.
So the resources that are reserved are on the original 200,000 acres and not just the part that's left. Is that what you're saying?
What's that now?
Okay, the 200,000 acres that was originally with the holdings that Maurice Strong had originally, is he still maintains the subsurface rights. Is that what you're saying? On the original 200,000 acres.
Well, that's a good point, too. Yeah, he does not maintain them officially. It's Lexham that owns them officially.
Okay.
But
he had to be able to sell them.
Right, okay. And that's a good point. Does Lexham own mineral rights next to the wildlife refuge? And the answer is yes. It owns mineral rights on the Sand Dunes National Park, because that was part of the original ranch, and the Baca Grand Subdivision community where I live. So, and they own some mineral rights out west of what's now the wildlife refuge and some a little bit to the north. So your question is very good. Now, why do you suppose they're going to put their first three test wells right on the National Wildlife Refuge when they also own some private land next to the wildlife refuge? I can't say that. I can't say that for sure, unless all of this is a scare tactic and what they're trying to do is get people to mobilize to put pressure on their congressmen so that there might be a federal buyout of mineral rights. Maybe to the tune of, you know, $40 or $50 million, and then their original $1 million investment would be, increased by 50 times or whatever. But
one of the reasons why I asked that is because even on that statement that's on the internet, that the EIA statement or EIS statement, is that had the pictures of the ranch on there, and that made me think, by the way, it was initially on the front page of it, it was like, The ranch was part of this possibility of being drilled.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Okay. The wildlife refuge is 92,000 acres.
Okay.
And that 92,000 acres was, a little less than half of the original Baca ranch.
And that will be right up abutting next to your subdivision, correct?
It abuts directly to our subdivision. And that picture that you're talking about, which is, the first page of the draft environmental assessment, that is the entranceway to the old Baca Ranch, which is now being used as headquarters for the new Baca National Wildlife Refuge. Now, it's interesting that while they scraped up the money to have a wildlife refuge, George Bush and his administration have cut back the funding to all these federal agencies to such an extent that they can only afford to have one person, Ron Garcia, manage that 92,000 acre wildlife refuge. And he does it from the old Baca Ranch, which is where, you know, Maurice and Hannah Strong used to live, and Gary Boyce, I guess, lived there for a while. So what they did is they just transferred that old ranch, which was, again, part of the original ranch, and now that's government property. And incidentally, you cannot walk onto that wildlife refuge, nor can I, because they say that we can't do it until there is a management plan. However, the wildlife refuge, and they haven't done a management plan yet to even show what they have on the new refuge, but the rules of the game are that Lexham can drive their huge, you know, 85,000 pound trucks out there with these huge
drill rigs,
etc. And so it's a very strange situation. It's supposed to be protecting the wildlife, but then the first thing they do is put these gigantic drill rigs on there with, you know, many, many, many huge trucks and potential for real devastation on the wildlife refuge, especially that they're drilling in wetlands.
Eric, I've got Matt Clark in here, too. He's another DJ here at the station, and he had a couple of questions.
Sure.
Hello, Eric. Can you hear me?
There we go.
Eric.
Does he get that?
Eric. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Okay. Hello. Yeah, it's Matt Clark here at KHN.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, Melody asked me to come in to sort of co-host and listen. But I, first of all, I just want to tell you that we appreciate you putting this into layman's terms for us and the listeners. I've been aware of this issue for a little while, but it's good to hear the nuts and bolts in a way I can understand, and it seems you're doing a good job.
Yeah, sure.
Following it. And it makes more sense to me. I'm wondering, I wanted to get back to the NEPA thing you mentioned and
right.
What that stands for, and it seems like that's kind of the, maybe the crux of the situation where it's at now. I mean, it seems, it's such an absurd contradiction in my mind of this whole notion of a wildlife refuge and then this drilling. It's just 180 degrees opposite, and it sounds like, to me, and the from our standpoint, more and more, this whole wildlife refuge notion is just a big cover. Like, it's a big front to allow corporate interests to segue into this. I mean, it doesn't really seem like wildlife is much of an issue or an intention by anybody. Am I right in this? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, under this administration, and of course George Bush and Dick Cheney are both gas and oil men.
You know, sure.
That's their business background. One of the first things they did when they came into power, George Bush signed executive order, I think it's 13213, which mandated that all federal agencies expedite all gas and oil drilling. Now most federal agencies, and now we're talking about the Bureau of Land Management, we're talking about the U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. Park Service, and the National Wildlife Refuges. Most of these are supposedly managed for multiple uses. You know, like the Forest Service has 7 or 8 official multiple uses, you know, things like recreation and wildlife, and timber is just one of those. But what happens when you get the fox guarding the hen house? When you put the industry executives in power to regulate the agency or to in the agencies that are supposed to regulate industry, and this is what we see, then they just turn these federal lands over to their corporate pals. And that includes, I think most hypocritically, the wildlife refuges, because you would think, you know, that they would be treated different. But in fact, I think about 30% of all the wildlife refuges in the country now have this kind of gas and oil exploration on them. So, yeah, this is a gigantic kind of a fraud. It's kind of a travesty of what the original intent of the agency was supposed to be.
One other thing that I noticed when I was researching some of the this information on the internet, I ran across a number of YouTube videos that people had uploaded from the Western Slope, and they give a really good indication of what can be done in a short period of time with these drilling rigs, and I mean, it looks like a bomb zone over there in the western slope.
Well, yeah, this is a good point, and you've given me a good idea for my website. I've got to get some of those pictures onto my website, you know, to show what could happen here, because pictures worth a thousand words.
And it isn't just the flat areas of over there by Rifle and Silt and that sort. I mean, they're getting up into the hills, into the really pristine wilderness areas, and they're not paying any attention to the headwaters, and whatever the chemicals that they're pumping into the ground. There was one interviewed driller over there who was pulling his crew out, who said he drilled 200 wells and had never seen an inspector, and he wasn't going to jeopardize his men's life anymore because of the chemicals that they were putting in the ground.
And he quit, as I recall. That's right. Yeah, it's true. Now, Halliburton, of course, is Dick Cheney's former company. In fact, he's still on the payroll, I believe. He was the CEO. They are involved in this gas bonanza and oil bonanza, and the thing that they've done is they've got patents on proprietary techniques in a process they call hydraulic fracturing. And what they try to do, especially with gas, is they try to actually set up little mini earthquakes by injecting tremendous amounts of water and sand under high pressure into wells that are not producing so well. And what this does is it sets up little mini earthquakes, and then it kind of the shocks cause the rocks to pull apart a bit, and the sand then holds these cracks open, and then the gas can migrate upward more freely. Well, it's proprietary information exactly what the suite of chemicals is that they use. You can't find that out. It's classified. However, there have been some leaks in Wyoming, and some chemists have gone over there and found, and like Theo Colborn, Dr. Theo Colborn, and she's got some websites about what she's found. And it's really quite startling, the carcinogens, fairly high percentage of carcinogens are involved, chemicals that attack the endocrine system. And she's got lots of data. I could give you some of that on my website if you want, but basically the stuff is, as one guy said who worked with the CIA says, this is a laundry list for chemical warfare, the chemicals that they use in the drilling process.
That's crazy.
And that's the hydraulic fracturing.
Eric,
so,
I have another question for you. I mean,
yeah.
Sorry to cut you off, but to get back to the Baca.
Yeah.
What would it take? It sounds like that while though the corporate agenda, the big corporations are the real enemy, it sounds like to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but can this fight be focused more on the so-called government, the so-called wildlife refuge people? Because it sounds like they're the real culprit as far as letting this happen. I mean, am I wrong in thinking that hypothetically, if this were to go through, Lexham owns the mineral rights and they do this, will they still maintain that it's a wildlife refuge on the surface? Is it still going to be a refuge?
That's right.
Supposedly. And that just is the ultimate ridiculousness right there.
Yeah.
Did they do that same thing with the Rocky Flats?
Yeah, indeed. But to go back to your question, is it Matt?
Yeah, Matthew.
Yeah, Matt. Yeah, the way this thing kind of, materializes here, Ron Garcia, who is the director here, the only guy working on the wildlife refuge, he's a local guy. He grew up in Conejos County, and he's a nice guy, and he's got a degree in wildlife biology, and his heart's in the right place. And Mike Blendon, who is the regional director in Alamosa, you know, probably pretty much the same. But these guys are, and of course they want to take care of this because they're wildlife biologists, and that's why they got into wildlife biology. But they're under tremendous pressure from above. I suppose it goes right up to the Department of Interior, and that probably goes right up to the White House. Under tremendous pressure to just fast-track these things through, because this is an oil and gas administration, and that's what they care about. That's what they know about. That's what they care about. And so, yeah, it's really a question of, do we have a democracy ruled by people, or do we have a corpocracy ruled by corporations?
Yeah.
And I would say there's no question when it comes to the administration of our public lands. People have been losing ground, and corporations, especially the gas and oil business, have been having their way. Now, this is the richest industry in the world, over $1 trillion a year. And they've had 100 years to get the laws written in their favor, and they have their boys in Washington. Now, there's some good signs. You know, Governor Ritter is a Democrat, and he's not quite so gung-ho about oil and gas development. Very difficult for people to have much of a voice under this present climate.
So what do you figure is, you know, I mean, in closing up, in closing comments on this, what do you think that, where this is going to go and what people can do about it?
Well, I think we really do need to look at it in the big terms that we're discussing. We need to look at it like, who owns this country? Is this country of, by, and for the people? We have government of, by, and for the people. Or do we have government of, by, and for the corporations? And certainly unless people get organized and get vocal and start putting pressure on their, you know, political leaders, we'll continue down this path of basically fascism. But if people do get involved and wake up and write and call their elected officials, you know, take this thing, citizenship, seriously, say, well, I'm not a consumer, I'm a citizen. You know, I own this country. George Bush lives in public housing. I pay for his housing. So why isn't he doing the right thing? You know, that kind of attitude. I think if people do have that attitude, and like you, Melody, and start doing things, then I think things can move back towards a more balanced and sane situation.
I think people need to be inspired to do that. They need to be empowered because it's such a remote area that, you know, a lot of people just, they don't know what we're dealing with. They don't know how beautiful and how great it is. You know, they might on the surface, but they've never, like, maybe been out there as much or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I do. Lexham has a website. I would encourage you to go to it. It's just explorations, you know, lexhamexplorations.com. Hmm. And one of the signs, you see there, They got these beautiful slides, you know, of all the sand dunes, and then the gas drill rig in front of the sand dunes, and, you know, they're trying to make this look aesthetic and everything. And they've got a big sign showing where this area is in Colorado, and then the big letters, politically safe.
Well,
and as you say, it's because people don't know about this place.
What if this guy that is in charge of the wildlife refuge, I forget his name again, Ron Garcia,
yeah.
What if people really just, and maybe you guys are doing this already, but just teamed up with him, supported him, and turned this guy more into an activist, you know?
Well, again, you know, this guy is a bureaucrat. He has to obey orders, and this is what happens when you work with the government. So his hands are tied. You've got to go over his head. You've got to go to the Salazar brothers. Go to Gail Schwartz.
What people might consider is to get the bigger picture and understand what's really going on, because what is happening in that area is kind of the microcosm of the macrocosm. You've got an elite around the world who are categorizing and tallying up all the resources, and they have written out documents that talk about all of this. And if people will study these documents, one of them being Agenda 21.
Yeah, and we're just, I mean, the interview is just about over, and we're getting into the really juicy stuff. I would encourage people to look at Agenda 21, which is an attempt to take over 50% of the land in America, and give it over to government control so that they can give it to their corporate buddies. But basically, you're right, food, energy, water, if you control those, you control the population.
And air, too.
And air, yeah.
So
you control those very basic things, You can control who lives and who dies.
And this, what's happening right here, is just an example of that. And so we kind of have to back up and really look at the bigger picture. Because if we just fight all these little battles, they're going to keep us fighting a lot of little battles. So.
Well, that's very good, very true. And I am going to try to get a web page up on these bigger things like Agenda 21 and the Trans-Texas Corridor and the North American Union, because I think somehow these things are related.
Okay, Eric, I really thank you for being flexible with us and giving us an update on the Lexham process. And next we're going to have Richard Gage. And again, thank you.
Hey, you bet. I'll be listening to Richard Gage. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay, bye-bye.